As we kind of look at where we're going in these last couple of weeks of our class, we'll begin talking this morning about advanced directives and what that is and how we might leave advanced directives to those who might be charged with caring for our health. We'll talk a little bit about the role of finances as that comes to bear upon decision making, as we might face various trials and how we ought to think of finances and medical care and those types of things, which will be, I'm sure, a fun discussion. And then the last week of the class, which will be the very end of March, Pastor McWilliams will actually be teaching that class, and he'll be talking about the differences between cremation and burial, how we ought to be thinking of those things, and then also what sort of things we should think about in memorial services, even as we are thinking about leaving instructions to our loved ones, or meeting with our pastors and communicating those types of things with them. So that's kind of where we'll go these last few weeks. So as we talk about advanced directives, here are a few things that we'll cover before we get to the handout, which we'll cover in a few minutes. First, we'll be designating a healthcare surrogate. What is meant, first of all, by that concept of a healthcare surrogate? Okay, yeah. Decisions for you when you're not capable, someone who stands in your place. What might be some reasons why it would be important to have a healthcare surrogate appointed?
You're unable to speak.
Okay, you can't speak.
Someone who knows your wishes.
Okay.
What you plan on, what you would or would not like.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Like so many things in life, you can't plan for. You can't know the future, so you need to plan ahead as if you're not going to have that ability. Because I mean, you, whether you have it or you don't have it, you need to be prepared. You know, mm-hmm. You don't get insurance for everyday accidents; you get it for when you need it, and that's kind of like insurance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you might think, okay, I'll just write down what I want done in all the different scenarios that I might face. Well, inevitably, there will be a scenario that comes up that you didn't predict or anticipate. And so someone who knows, I'm sure what you're getting at, Tom, someone who knows what your convictions are and who can act according to those, that could step in the place of you to make those decisions that you would make if you had the capacity and the ability to do so. And let's talk a little bit more about the criteria for selecting a healthcare surrogate. What sorts of things do we need to think about in terms of choosing that particular surrogate?
Start with a reasonable person.
Okay, a reasonable person. What do we mean by a reasonable person, doctor?
Somebody who, if the scenario is not something you've discussed with them, can make a reasonable decision.
Okay.
And so, to me, that's the initial thing, and not all family members are necessarily reasonable.
Right. And I think the way in which we define that reasonable person is really critical, because we want someone, we've talked in our material about how we want someone who will represent us, even though they might think differently, right, if they're in that particular situation, but we want them to act in our stead. So that's important as well. It's important to have someone who has that conviction that they will adhere to your wishes that you've left behind.
That's important to discuss with your family too, especially if you have multiple children, because you can create a lot of dissension in the family if you give one child that particular responsibility among and not the others. That can create
Right. Yeah, and even if you are appointing one person and you're communicating that with your other children or what have you, to make sure that the other children understand what those convictions are as well. I was talking with a friend who's in healthcare, and he said, even if there is an advance directive if there's a child who comes and brings that, and they're the ones who've been the healthcare surrogate, if there's another sibling who does not agree with that and they're vocal about their differences, the medical staff will not administer according to that advance directive for fear of potential lawsuit and so forth. So there has to be unanimity among the children. So when you have 10 children or so, that can be a bit difficult, I suppose. Want to make sure that they're all in agreement with those types of things.
They're all in agreement. Which I think also drives home the point, you probably want someone a little bit younger than you, because you don't know what station, you know, someone who maybe you're a similar age, you know, to make those decisions. They may not be at the capability point
right
when the time comes, so you probably want someone a little bit younger, like children or something like
that. Yeah, yeah, and that sort of lends into the next point that I was going to make about having an alternate surrogate. The document that we'll look at has a location to place an alternate. One, in case you don't update it for a number of years and the person who was your surrogate is no longer living or able to make those decisions. Or if you have someone who's your first surrogate, they happen to travel a lot or be in a place where you can't reach them, it's good to have an alternate who is available. Another thing that we'll discuss this morning as we move along is establishing a living will, and we'll cover a couple of samples that are legal and binding in the state of Florida. And then we'll talk a little bit about whether to sign a DNR or not, a do not resuscitate. I think we've touched on that some in weeks past. Do you think that as a believer that we have that right or the prerogative to sign a DNR? Okay, and in what sort of circumstances? I mean, we can't pick every scenario, of course, but what type of circumstances would it be appropriate?
You're on life support, and you're just going to be put right back on life support right after, and you're just kind of in that permanent state. Why keep on resuscitating yourself just to be in that vegetative state?
Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Do you have something, John? Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
I was going to say brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
But even not, I mean, if you're elderly, if you're at a point where your quality of life is going to be really poor, and you're going to, depending on that call, I mean, it doesn't have to actually be brain dead. Yeah. I don't think that, you know, if you're dependent on certain things to keep you alive, I don't think that that's biblically necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about some various criteria. Davis unpacks a number of those in his books, or in his book rather, about different scenarios in terms of debilitating diseases and you know, humanly speaking, lack of recovery from such things. Now, a DNR, and some of y'all have helped with this as well. I don't think Sherry's here this morning, but Becky, last week we were talking about this. And in talking with other healthcare professionals, that you might have a DNR, and in the state of Florida, again, it's supposed to be on a yellow piece of paper in a very visible location. But if the paramedics are called and those first responders, I've heard them described as sort of like a beagle, like they are just tenacious and they will focus upon what they are called to do, which is to administer CPR. Even if there's a DNR right in front of their face, they'll just go past it because they're called to administer CPR. So even in assisted living facilities, and this is why the medical staff in those locations need to be aware of where those documents are so that they don't call paramedics if that time arises.
When we admitted my sister, my oldest sister, to the rehab and nursing home, they had their own documents that she also had to sign in addition to what she already had in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of that might vary from state to state. Of course, if you move to another state, it'd be worth looking into what those differences might be. And then we'll talk, whether this week or next, about implementing those documents and then amending them as time goes on. If your convictions change or if there are advances in medical science that lead you to add some sort of amendments to that document and how to go about doing that and recording the needed signatures that you need. Now, in the state of Florida, you have to have two witnesses to that document. It doesn't have to be notarized, and the two witnesses cannot be either of the healthcare surrogates. And those witnesses, of course, have to be of age. And those documents can always be revoked or amended. You can revoke them by just writing something over the top of them or throwing it away, and of course, creating a new one, destroying the original. Oftentimes, you would have a copy, perhaps, that you pass along to that healthcare surrogate. So if you do make an amendment, you want to make sure that you track down those copies and have those destroyed and replaced with the replacement. And if you do have a new one, a new advance directive, obviously it would supersede the old. It's important to keep the original signed document in an accessible location, not in a safe deposit box, but somewhere, or safe or something, but somewhere where you can get to it. And again, you're communicating with others where that document is. If you are making copies and distributing those to the healthcare surrogate, family, physicians, much is online these days. So there might be places even within your portal with Watson Clinic or something where you can scan a document and put it there, something along those lines. But of course, the more copies that you make and the more it's distributed, then if you do amend it, you've got to remember where those things are to go and replace them. And again, the importance of family members being unified. If there's one family member who's not in agreement, that could trump all other documents because of fear of litigation. So let's go ahead and turn to this particular handout that y'all have that says five wishes. Now, there are different versions of advanced directives that you can find online. Some of them are free. Some of them have a minimal cost involved. This one is probably the easiest to understand. It's $5. I purchased a couple of them for my wife and I. It basically looks exactly like this, except it doesn't say sample on it. And it's bound in a little bit nicer paper and easier to file and such. There's a website, I think it's on the back of this. It's agingwithdignity.org, where you can go to find this particular document and download it. And this is in compliance with all Florida laws and statutes and everything. Another place that you can go, I don't think I put this website there, is you can go to the website where Bill Davis's book is available at the publisher. And there's a couple of links that he has. And then those links take you to another site where you type in the state in which you live. And then for the state of Florida, there's a bunch of things that you can look at. Living wills, advanced directives, organ donation, do not resuscitate, all those types of things are there. So that's at prpbooks.com, which is Presbyterian Reform's publisher. Is that right, Ellen? PNR?
Yeah,
PNR. prpbooks.com /book/ Departing in Peace, or you can just probably go to Departing in Peace and you can find it there. So let's look here at the first page, and we'll just kind of read through this document. We'll talk about each of the different points of the wishes as we go along. Did you get one of these, Bill? Were there none back there on the music stand?
No.
No, sorry, I ran out, Waller. Do y'all have one that you can share between you? Okay. I can get you some more tomorrow. There are many things in life that are out of our hands. This Five Wishes document gives you a way to control something very important, how you are treated if you get seriously ill, It's an easy-to-complete form that lets you say exactly what you want. Once it's filled out and properly signed, it's valid under the laws of most states. What is Five Wishes? Well, Five Wishes is the first living will that talks about your personal, emotional, and spiritual needs as well as your medical wishes. It lets you choose the person you want to make healthcare decisions for you if you are not able to make them for yourself. Five Wishes lets you say exactly how you wish to be treated if you get seriously ill. It was written with the help of the American Bar Association's Commission on Law and Aging and the nation's leading experts in end-of-life care. It's also easy to use. All you have to do is check a box, circle a direction, or write a few sentences. And how Five Wishes can help you and your family. It lets you talk with your family, friends, and doctor about how you want to be treated if you become seriously ill. Your family members will not have to guess what you want. It protects them if you become seriously ill because they won't have to make hard choices without knowing your wishes. And you can know what your mom, dad, spouse, or friend wants. You can be there for them when they need you most. You will understand what they really want. We can skip that next section there. And they go on a little bit more talking about, of course, the state in which it's valid and how to change the five wishes, which we'd mentioned, of course, destroying the old ones if you're going to amend it and so forth, and making copies and distributing those to your surrogate. So let's look at page 4, selecting an agent. Again, as we think about this agent, we're thinking about someone who is willing to act in our place, who is comfortable, although it's, of course, a difficult thing for them to do, but they recognize it as a responsibility. One who shares your biblical convictions is someone who's preferable, but even if they do differ from you, if they have differing convictions, someone who's willing to honor your particular convictions, even though they might think differently. Now, that might be a little bit tricky because you don't want to bind someone's conscience to step in your place to do certain things, right? So if someone does have a real difference on what you're putting in this particular document, you don't want to force them to do that or make them feel guilty because they're a spouse or a child and they better do what you say, but find someone else who does share those convictions and who can act for you as that surrogate. Again, a person who clearly understands what you are wishing and has the ability to act decisively if a new situation arises that isn't predicted. Again, someone who can act in that reasonable manner, who shares those same convictions and so forth. We can't really say here who is biblically required to serve as your agent. There are certainly various people that you can choose to be your agent, a spouse, a child, a sibling, a close friend. But since you can't make the case that someone is biblically obligated to serve as your agent, you need to avoid pressing someone to do something that they're uncomfortable with doing. Even a spouse may not wish to be put in that position, and so it would be wise to find someone else. And so using these five wishes can help you discuss, again, as it says at the beginning, don't just fill this out, make a copy, and send it to somebody, but use it as a platform to discuss more clearly what those particular convictions are and what wishes you have. So let's read through this first wish a bit. The person I want to make healthcare decisions for me when I can't make them for myself. And it reads, if I'm no longer able to make my own healthcare decisions, this form names the person I choose to make these choices for me. This person will be my healthcare agent or other term that may be used in any state, such as proxy, representative, or surrogate. This person will make my healthcare choices if both of these things happen. My attending or treating doctor finds I'm no longer able to make healthcare choices, and another healthcare professional agrees that this is true. If my state has a different way of finding that I am not able to make healthcare choices, then my state's way should be followed. And then you can see there's a place to put the person that you choose as your healthcare agent. And the document talks about even if you are divorced from someone, that person can still, of course, serve as your agent. it's not the dissolution of the marriage relationship doesn't make this document null and void.
Yeah. I just had a question for you, and some of the medical people in the group might be able to answer this, but I was just reading recently, you know, we have this impression from years ago that if you were hospitalized, you know, your attending physician would come visit you and all this. And today, I guess that's no longer true. Don't hospitals employ hospitalists, which, you know, they don't necessarily know you at all.
I think we talked a bit about the intensivist or that doctor who's going to be doing the rounds and so forth. And so that's why I think it is important to have that document with that surrogate who is able to make those decisions. That's not to say that your primary care physician isn't going to have a say in things. It could be that he makes rounds eventually at some point, or you can get in touch with his nurse or with him to get some sort of consultation on how to handle things.
Well, I think that's a good reason to talk to your own doctor. Mm-hmm. If you have the opportunity, obviously, some of the situations wouldn't allow for that, but if you're in a situation with a disease or a process that you know is leading to imminent death, if you could talk to your own physician, I think it gives you a lot of personal peace in making that decision. Along with your surrogate, and if you have a family member or someone who you know is going to be your surrogate or already is, take them along to those discussions.
So you can see on the document where there's a place to put two alternates, your second choice and then a third choice. Let's look at the box there at the bottom of page 4 where it says, picking the right person to be your healthcare agent. She's someone who knows you very well, cares about you, and who can make difficult decisions. A spouse or family member may not be the best choice because they are too emotionally involved. Sometimes they are the best choice. You know best. Choose someone who is able to stand up for you so that your wishes are followed. Also, choose someone who is likely to be nearby so they can help when you need them. Whether you choose a spouse, family member, or friend as your health care agent, make sure you talk about these wishes and be sure that person agrees to respect and follow your wishes. That person should be at least 18 years or older. Your health care provider, including the owner or operator of a health or residential or community care facility serving you, these are people that it should not be, is what they're saying, an employee or spouse of an employee of your health care provider serving as an agent or proxy for 10 or more people, unless it's a spouse or close relative. And then on the next page, the bullet points here is what you are affirming and the things that you don't want your agent to do or things that you just scratch out from these bullet points. First is to make choices for me about my medical care or services like tests, medicine, or surgery. This care or service could be to find out what my health problem is or how to treat it. It can also include care to keep me alive. If the treatment or care has already started, my healthcare agent can keep it going or have it stopped. Interpret any instructions I have given in this form or given in other discussions according to my healthcare agent's understanding of my wishes and values. Consent to admission to an assisted living facility, hospital, hospice, or nursing home for me. My healthcare agent can hire any kind of healthcare worker I may need to help me or take care of me. My agent may also fire a healthcare worker if needed. Make the decision to request. Was that you, Cammy?
No.
Oh, that was Donna. Make the decision to request, take away, or not give medical treatments, including artificially provided food and water and any other treatments to keep me alive. See and approve release of my medical records and personal files. If I need to sign my name to get any of these files, my healthcare agent can sign it for me. Move me to another state to get care I need or to carry out my wishes. Authorize or refuse to authorize any medication or procedure needed to help with pain. Take any legal action needed to carry out my wishes. Donate usable organs or tissues of mine as allowed by law. Apply for Medicare, Medicaid, or other programs or insurance benefits for me. My healthcare agent can see my personal files, like bank records, to find out what is needed to fill out these forms. Listed below.
Also have
case.
Yeah, and the power of attorney would be a separate document, of course.
Right, but I think
would be on this.
Have that to apply to the other, but I might be wrong.
Well, if it everything that's listed in here is legal and binding, so power of attorney might be something, durable power of attorney would be something a little bit different. Sorry.
The banks won't accept those. If it says they can, we won't accept it. They have to have power of attorney to see that.
No?
Well, supposedly, this is legally binding and approved in Tallahassee. So, well, they'll just have to talk to your bank manager, I guess. And they mention here about organ donation. I don't know that we've talked a lot about that in the class. There's a great book by a guy named Gilbert Mylander, who's written on bioethics fairly extensively. And here's a few things that from that particular book that he's written that I thought were helpful. He points out that in 1968, there was an ad hoc committee at Harvard who recommended a neurological criterion of cessation of brain activity for determining death. So prior to that, prior to 1968, cessation of heart and lung activity, which was a cardiopulmonary criterion, had generally been used, of course, to mark the point of death. And so the committee made the determination, because you have these advances in medical technology that's able to keep the heart pumping and lungs breathing, and so then brain death is the only category remaining. But Mylander points out that the concept of brain death remains conceptually and experientially puzzling. He points out that this is not an always an easy thing to determine. The activity of the brain may be measurable in some cases, but not in others, and so it's not quite as objective as we might presume. He goes on to talk about the thirst for transplantable organs is so strong that we are tempted to redefine death in order to harvest those needed organs. And so let's say, for example, that someone is being kept alive by a ventilator, but they're declared brain dead. Now, for a loved one who it doesn't look hopeless because there's still chest compressions and the heart is still beating, and so a ventilator might be removed to determine if the person can breathe on his own. We've talked in our class that would be a permissible thing to do. But if organs are deprived of oxygen for too long, then of course they die and they're not able to be used for transplant. And so it's entirely possible that the healthcare surrogate is pressed to make a decision that she's not comfortable with in order to harvest those organs. So Mylander says, when death becomes simply an obstacle on the way to organ procurement, we permit our desire to mitigate the organ shortage to undermine our attempts to keep company with the dying. And so his point here is that death, of course, is something that's very traumatic. Imagine the challenge of needing to make a decision on whether those organs ought to be taken from someone who's dying while you're simultaneously grieving and then wanting to be in the presence of that loved one for as long as possible. And you obviously can't be in the room when the organs are taken from that loved one. And so Mylander concludes by saying that only by supporting organ transplantation in ways that do not lose the meaning of the body as the place of our personal presence, in ways that preserve the possibility of a humane death, and in ways that do not imply that staying alive as long as possible always has moral trump, can we become people who give thanks for medical progress without worshiping it or placing their trust in it. In becoming such people, we may bear a different kind of life-giving witness to our world. And so he talks about this important balance here, right, between not the presumption that we're going to do everything medically possible, nor feel as though we need to be pressed into making a decision that we're not comfortable with until as that person is dying and so forth. So organ transplantation can be a tricky thing, of course. And there's ways, I think, even in this document to specify what you exactly mean by that, because it could be that you donate your body to science and it's used for medical research. I've read a book that was interesting where it talked about bodies that might be donated that they would use. You see those crash test dummies, but they actually would put bodies in cars and smash them into walls because they want to see how the body itself reacts to. Or bodies that would be placed in, I think it was a school, medical examiner school, and so they place bodies in different locations to measure decomposition so that they can then determine when they do find someone who was murdered and left somewhere. They have that criteria to compare it with. Yeah. Sorry, Bill.
Do you, I don't know this, do you know what age is the cutoff for organ transplant?
The age? Mm-mm. No.
That's a good question.
I don't. Yeah, I've thought about that, but.
Well, I mean, I would assume after a certain age, they're not going to harvest your
right
organ, so you won't be facing that particular problem.
Right.
It's the younger people that, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, right. You wouldn't want to put a 75-year-old.
Those organ transplant people can really go after you. In other words, press you big time.
Yeah.
To do something you don't want to do.
They'll raise that age limit once we're able to transplant brains.
That's true. I'm waiting to get to the point where we can clone. We have to clone Alan. We've got to keep him around as long as we can. So at the bottom here of page 5, again, if you change your mind about having a healthcare agent, here's what you would do is destroy all copies, tell someone, such as doctor or family, that I want to cancel or change that agent, or write the word revoked.
Jeff, if you're licensed, if you're an organ donor, putting it on your driver's license, that's not enough to, I realize you have to be able to communicate that some way to the powers that be when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that official enough for organ transplant?
Right. Yeah, my understanding is that, if it's on your driver's license, then that would be sufficient enough. So that's why there's some people who reconsider putting that on their driver's license because of the scenario that Bill is sort of describing. So let's go to wish 2 on page 6. Type of treatment or the quality of life section. The goal here is to help people choose what we would choose, that healthcare surrogate choose what we would choose so that they don't have to try to guess or try to put themselves in our place to figure it out. So it's my wish for the kind of medical treatment I want or don't want. I believe that my life is precious and I deserve to be treated with dignity. When the time comes that I am very sick and am not able to speak for myself, I want the following wishes and any other directions I have given to my healthcare agent to be respected and followed. What you should keep in mind as a caregiver, I do not wish to be in pain. I want my doctor to give me enough medicine to relieve my pain, even if that means that I will be drowsy or sleep more than I would otherwise. I do not want anything done or omitted by my doctors or nurses with the intention of taking my life. I want to be offered food and fluids by mouth and kept clean and warm. And what life support treatment means to me. Life support treatment means any medical procedure, device, or medication to keep me alive. Life support treatment includes medical devices put in me to help me breathe, food and water supplied by medical devices, tube feeding, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, major surgery, blood transfusions, dialysis, antibiotics, and anything else meant to keep me alive. If I wish to limit the meaning of life support treatment because of my religious or personal beliefs, I will write these limitations in the space below. I do this to make very clear what I want and under what conditions. And then in case of emergency there, they speak about do not resuscitate documents and so forth, that those things must be filled out. And again, those are things that you can find online. On the next page, here's the kind of medical treatment that I want or don't want in the four situations listed below. I want my healthcare agent, family, doctors and other healthcare providers, friends and others to know these directions. Close to death. If my doctor and another healthcare professional both decide that I'm likely to die within a short period of time and life support treatment would only delay the moment of my death, then you choose one. I want to have life support treatment. I do not want life support treatment if it has been started. I want it stopped. I want to have life support treatment if my doctor believes it could help, but I want my doctor to stop giving me life support treatment if it's not helping my health condition or symptoms. In a coma and not expected to wake up or recover. If my doctor and another healthcare professional both decide that I am in a coma from which I'm not expected to wake up or recover, and I have brain damage and life support treatment would only delay the moment of my death, then I would want to have life support treatment. I do not wish to have it. If it's been started, I want it stopped. I want to have it if my doctor believes it can help, but I want my doctor to stop giving me life support treatment if it's not helping my health condition or symptoms. And then permanent and severe brain damage and not expected to recover. If my doctor and another healthcare professional both decide that I have permanent and severe brain damage, for example, I can open my eyes, but I cannot speak or understand, I'm not expected to get better, and life support treatment would only delay the moment of my death. And again, you choose one of those three. In another condition under which I do not wish to be kept alive. If there's another condition under which I do not wish to have life support treatment, I describe it below. In this condition, I believe that the costs and burdens of life support treatment are too much and not worth the benefits to me. Therefore, in this condition, I do not want life support treatment. For example, you may write end-stage condition. That means your health has gotten worse. You are not able to take care of yourself in any way, mentally or physically. Life support treatment will not help you recover. Any thoughts or questions there on that particular wish to?
You know, it sounds throughout that, you know, as this is written, that you have this close relationship to your doctor. And that may not be the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a hospital situation, I mean, who's your doctor at that point? Is that the Harvard resident, you know, that's trying to look after four people, or mm-hmm. is that your personal doctor?
It's probably not. It's probably somebody who doesn't know you that well.
Right.
So what are you saying? Because they don't get to make the final decision.
No.
You mean you wonder whether they come to the family and say, hey, they're not going to get better. You might as well turn off that. And you're not trusting that medical person to give you the right information? Is that what I'm hearing?
No, it just seems like all these judgments in this. If my doctor feels this, if my doctor feels that.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
You're saying you don't trust the decision of the doctor.
Well,
these people
are perfectly reasonable,
right,
and be happy to talk to your doctor.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's, I think, very worthwhile to talk to the person who takes care of you most of the time and simply tell the hospitalist, you know, talk to the doctor, and they will.
And then if they come to you and say, hey, he's telling you all the right, when I agree with his diagnosis and everything, that you would feel more comfortable. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think as well, Bill, I'm sure you can envision a situation where your primary care physician doesn't have the same skills and abilities as the doctor who's attending to you at the hospital. But just because you don't have a relationship with him doesn't mean that he doesn't have your best interest, or that he has better skills and abilities there as well. So I think in this context, I think the doctor can be applied more broadly. You're not necessarily saying my doctor is my primary care physician. You're saying my doctor is the one who is giving oversight to my health in that particular setting.
And I think that at that time, you got to start praying about God leading you in the right direction for this decision that you have to have some point at which you trust those other people. to give you the right information.
And I wasn't saying I did.
No, I know, but I was trying to get at the bottom of what you were saying.
He just likes to get everybody riled up. So. Yeah, Becky?
But it's not always cut and dry. I was in a situation where the cardiologist was saying one thing and the pulmonologist was saying another. And there you've got the two medical people telling you two different things, and that's really hard to decide. You know, like you say, then you got to be brave. You make the right decision. Or, you know, you're making the best decision you can. God's in control.
Exactly.
That's what we have to rely on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the end, you have to trust that God is going to help you.
Right. Right.
I just think you should realize that when you fill out these directives. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kelly?
I just was wondering, because I am not medical by any stretch, but I was looking at the permanent and severe brain damage and not expected to recover. Is that saying that the person is conscious? I was wondering if maybe...
You can't be conscious.
I don't know. I just needed maybe...
There are things like pain, we can tell from, you know, if you can prick them with a needle and they don't move at all, you know, those kind of responses. Mm-hmm. But they aren't awake, can't be awake.
This example says I can open my eyes, but I can't speak or understand.
Right, well you can't.
Okay, is this assuming they're on life support right now? Because if they can open their eyes and look at you, without being on life support, okay, they're still alive. They're breathing on their own.
Right.
They may not understand what
they're talking. I think the context there, is for life support.
Yeah, they're alive.
I was gonna say another thing that I've run into with families not understanding exactly what a DNR is, and they see it and they think that means like it's a death sentence.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily true. For example, I had a patient who had pulmonary fibrosis, which is, you know, it's a disease of the lungs. And it doesn't mean that if she was sick, she had some kind of respiratory virus or something like that, so we were supporting her to get through that. She did have a DNR. She didn't want to be intubated. She was very specific about what she didn't want done. But that doesn't mean that when she starts having a hard time breathing, we just say, oh, she's a DNR, you know. We're going to actually treat that. We're going to give her oxygen up to the point, you know, of not intubating because she didn't want that specifically. But when someone is signed a DNR, that doesn't mean that you're not going to treat their symptoms and not going to try and make them better within the means that you're able mm-hmm. to, up to the limits where they've set
right.
in the DNR.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. That's helpful.